Okay, Boker Tov. For those who were in the other lecture, I'll just reintroduce Rabbi. I'll introduce him for the first time. Rabbi, you know, Dishi, it's interesting. Both Rabbi Dishi and Rabbi Horowitz won the Chidon HaTanakh for the United States. Came in first place, which is, I guess, appropriate on a conference on Tanakh. So they both came in first place in Chidon. Rabbi Dishi is a member of the Syrian community. I believe he grew up in Flatbush, and which I know is the heart of the Syrian community in New York. He lives now in Alon Shvut. He is actually a lawyer in private practice. He did his law degree in the States, and then he worked as a clerk in the Israeli Supreme Court, worked for the Ministry of Justice. I guess he had enough of Israeli politics. I don't know exactly. He went into private practice. And, of course, as you already know, he has an expertise in Tanakh. This is the book he recently published that comes highly praised. That's available here for sale. And he'll be speaking, I think, you know, like part of the book or, you know, some of the items he discussed in the book. And Vakasha Harav Dishi.
Yes, that's important. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi, for both inviting me and introducing me. And I would like again to share with you basically what's the very beginning of the book of Jacob's Family Dynamics. And it will give you a sense, perhaps, of what we're trying to explore in the book by the time we finish this lecture. So first of all, we're dealing with the episode of Yaakov usurping the blessings of Esav, and he masquerades as Esav in order to achieve this goal. And we, every time we come to this parsha in the yearly cycle of the laning, people have this problem. We have ethical problems with the behavior of Yaakov, and we want to relate to Yaakov as Yaakov Avinu, our forefather. And there's a direct tension. How are we going to relate to Yaakov as our great revered forefather when he does terrible things, or what looks to be terrible things, in Parashat Toldot, Perek Kaf Zayin. And that's basically the handout that you have here, is Perek Kaf Zayin of Sefer Breshit, translated into English, so that we'll be able to make easy reference. Now, if we look at the problems that Yaakov faces on a, so to speak, charge sheet, if he were to be brought up on charges for the things that he did that day, he takes advantage of a blind person and manipulates particularly their handicap, their being blind, in order to achieve his goal. He steals someone else's identity, right? Maybe the first case of identity theft, right here, Yaakov taking over Esav's identity. He is also taking advantage of an elderly man who is definitely over 100 years old at this point. Yitzchak is over 100. And so he's an old man. It happens to be that this old man is also his father. And it adds another level of repulsion to everyone else to hear that it's not only is he doing such a nasty act, but he's doing it to his own father and his own father who believes he's on his deathbed. Right? He calls them over, as we're going to see later when we read through the verses, Yitzchak believes he's about to die. And that's why this whole episode is generated. And Yaakov nonetheless feels that that's the time. Now I'm going to take advantage of my blind old father, and I'm going to get what I want. I'm going to get these blessings, even if it costs whatever it's going to cost. And I'm going to also, at the same time, take things away, steal things away that belong to my brother, and take his identity doing it as well. This doesn't seem to be a very flattering charge sheet. You know, deceit, you know, stealing, these types of things, they can go to many years in prison. But as we say, we don't have to worry, for we have the greatest of Jewish minds throughout the world came together throughout the centuries, and slowly but surely have tried valiantly to defend Yaakov, the greatest defense counsels throughout the years. Perhaps we will just explore one school of thought. There's two schools of thought that I'm going to present here. The first school of thought that came to the defense of Yaakov is perhaps that of the world of the main thoughts in the Midrash, although the world of Midrash is very vast, and I don't really like to generalize that Midrash has one school of thought, because clearly it does not. But the world of Midrash, brought to us through Rashi's eyes, tries very hard to present Yaakov in the best of light, and really tries to focus in on minute detail, reinterpreting certain words, and giving us the feeling that maybe perhaps Yaakov was not so bad after all. And if we just take a look at the verses that we have printed up for you here, let's take it, for example, what kind of play on words Rashi is introducing to us through the eyes of the Midrash to help alleviate Yaakov's moral position. So if we look now, Yaakov enters the tent of where Yitzchak is, and we're in Pasuk number 19. Okay? Vayomer Yaakov el Aviv, Yaakov tells his father, Anochi Esav Bechorecha, I am Esav, your firstborn. Well, that's kind of like, you know, it's very hard to wiggle out of that one. You know, Yaakov is saying, I am Esav, and he's lying. And that's the deception. There's a deception in that lie. Well, Rashi is not to be deterred by that language, and he interprets it, as perhaps you might have heard earlier, before you came to this lecture, Anochi, I am who I am, Popeye the Sailor Man, I am who I am, and that's someone, that's one thing, but Esav Bechorecha, Esav is your firstborn. So there's some pregnant pause that's here, that Rashi is telling you, look, you're reading a text, and there's words on a page, and it doesn't have punctuation in the Torah. So I'm explaining to you, Rashi says, that really there's a comma there, maybe even a colon. There's a pause, Anochi, Esav Bechorecha, and if you were there, you would have heard it that way. That's one understanding that Rashi is trying to explain to us. However, if we continue in that same verse, right? Asiti kasher dibarta elai. I did as you told me. Now, as we'll go through again later, Yitzchak didn't have any direct conversation with Yaakov at all. His direct conversation was with Esav. So how could Yaakov say, I did as you told me? Again, this is a lie. This is part of the deceit. So Rashi again says, oh no, again you have to do the same type of a read. Asiti, kasher dibarta elai, I did like you told me, not today. I did what you told me. Remember when I was a little kid, you told me to get a cup of water. I got you the cup of water. So that's what I did. I did that back then. I did that. So clearly, I mean, Rashi is not playing around. He's not trying to fool us. Okay, Rashi has a clear agenda. And he wants very hard to explain to us to be able to see Yaakov in a positive light. And this is not only Rashi, but again, there's lines in Midrash that are, this is where he's quoting it from, right? Rashi is not making this stuff up himself. So the first idea of Yaakov perhaps not having committed any of these wrongs is one line of defense for Yaakov. But we get this sense of this, you know, Merchant of Venice perhaps, like, you know, very didacting on, exacting on the words. If we can just show that the language that Yaakov said wasn't a lie, then suddenly everything Yaakov did was fine. Clearly, the wording of the lie is a minor detail in regards to the entire props and event and the taking of the blessings, and it becomes very difficult to maintain this line of thought throughout. Now, along with this, we should really try to understand why Rashi has this impulse to try to teach us that Yaakov was Sadiq. There's no way we can reprimand Yaakov. And I think that Gilad ben Sasson, he has a thesis paper for his MA that was titled Pokdei Avon Avot, where we remember the sins of the fathers. And there he suggests that perhaps really we need to take into account historical contexts. This is not new. Gilad ben Sasson is not the only one who says this. I think people who study Rashi systematically have definitely come across this idea that Rashi lives in the time of the Crusades, in the times where Christianity is posing a threat, a physical threat, to the Jewish community. And basically the way out of being killed is to convert to Christianity. One of the claims that Christianity was making is that, look, we are the chosen people, because you're not the chosen people anymore, because look who you came from. Okay, look at these forefathers that you have. They've been nasty people. Look at Yaakov. Yaakov does all of these trickeries, and he's not an honest person, and therefore he was rejected. His offspring was rejected, and now we are the sons of the light. We are the people who are chosen, and therefore you should join us, the good guys, Christianity. And I think that perhaps, whether consciously or unconsciously, I wasn't there to interview Rashi, but clearly, I think that one of the messages that Rashi needs to give over to his modern, to his community, his contemporary community, was that we are the chosen people, and all of this talk that they tell you about Yaakov, that's all nonsense. Okay, our forefathers were the best, and you should be proud of who you are. And even if it looks like it's not so clean, I'll explain it to you. Okay, come to me, we'll take care of it. Stay Jewish. So perhaps this was what's going on in the backdrop of Rashi's interpretation, but clearly he is addressing the issue, the moral issues that are arising from this passage. No one is denying that there are things that need to be dealt with here. Now, in addition to Yaakov being picked up on the pedestal, we also have another theme that connects with this one in the same school of thought, which is Esav bashing. Okay, Esav bashing means that anything that Esav does is bad. Just breathing is bad. Anything Esav does, it can't be good. So we have Midrashim that attribute Esav with the most terrible of things. The verse says that Esav was a hunter, which normally would mean he hunts animals. Comes the Midrashim and say, no, he did not only hunt animals. He also hunted people. And he killed them. He was an assassin. And not only did he hunt other people, but he hunted other people's wives, meaning that he was also an adulterer. And he was also struggling with Yaakov in the womb to try to get out to go worship Avodah Zarah. So here we have an embryonic state, Esav, before he's even born, he's already labeled as wicked and evil. And when he comes into the world, everything he does is evil and wicked. And even the one thing that the text says that is what Yitzchak loves about him, it says, "Vayechav Yitzchak et Esav, ki tzayid befiv." Yitzchak loved Esav because the hunt was in his mouth. Okay, now this is a very strange pasuk. We'll go into it maybe a little bit more. But basically, ki tzayid befiv, because he used to bring home the hunt. Why did Yitzchak like this? And whose mouth is befiv? Is it Esav's mouth, Yitzchak's mouth? Bottom line is, he was doing something with the hunt. Come the rabbis and say, ki hayat tzadet aviv befiv, that Esav would be hunting Yitzchak with his mouth. He wanted to show that he was a righteous individual. And he would ask his father, oh, Isaac, my father, Yitzchak, do we need to take ma'asrot from melach, from the salt? Now, salt doesn't have a rule of having to take ma'asrot from it. Okay? And therefore, Yitzchak would say, oh, you're such a righteous person. You even want to take from salt the tithing to give over to other people. But, you know, you don't need to do that, my righteous son. Oh, what a shepping nachas. So, clearly, this midrash understands that it's anachronistic to talk about it, right? Because there's no institution of ma'asrot until much later. And there's no one to give the ma'asrot to. Okay? There's no ma'aser going on. There doesn't exist ma'aser at the time of Yaakov and Esav. And therefore, it's clear that the people in the Midrash are painting a picture for us. It's not that they are literally expecting us to take literally what it is they said. So again, we have Yaakov being put up on a pedestal, trying to explain in the best possible terms and light the things that Yaakov does. At the same time, we have Esav bashing to put Esav down as much as possible so that when the things that go on happen, we can say, ah, Esav, that no good for nothing kid, that trickster, he deserves to be tricked. He deserves to be taken away those blessings. He doesn't deserve those blessings. Yaakov deserves them. He is the righteous individual. He was Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. He learned Torah all day and all night. So therefore, Yaakov deserves the blessings, Esav does not deserve the blessings. And this is indeed one school of thought that holds throughout, and there are many people today that will adhere to this up and down, and this is the way they understand it, and there's no way of talking to them otherwise. There's another approach, which is perhaps a little bit more modern, and that is we're going to now shift blame away from Yaakov, and we're going to now put the blame on someone else's doorstep, but it's not going to be Esav, we're going to put the blame at Rivka's doorstep. Now, Rivka is his mother, and Rivka is being depicted in this school of thought as a very active woman. And indeed, her biblical history and goings on is very active. She's the one, even when she was first introduced to us, back in Haran, in the old country. She was the woman who ran and got the water for Abraham's servant, and she gave the camels to drink, and she would run home and inform her father Lavan about this, her brother Lavan, that this was the case. And very much, very active, as opposed to Yitzchak, who is being presented in this school of thought, which I don't agree with, but Yitzchak has a school of thought that is very passive. Since the time of the binding on the altar, he basically lost his love of life, and therefore he is very passive. And this school of thought wants to present Rivka as the main force in getting the blessings. And indeed, when we look through the verses here, we can see in verse number 5, V'rivka shomat v'deber Yitzchak el Esav beno. She was the one who overhears Yitzchak talking to her son Esav. And she is the one in verse 6, V'rivka amra Yaakov ben Alemor. She is the one who reports to Yaakov what's going on. And then she tells him in verse 7, Havi Ali Tzayit. She's the one, she's coming up with the plan, she's giving him the whole, exactly, step-by-step instructions. Well, Rivka is very active, so why are we gaining anything from this approach? If Rivka is to blame, so now I had a problem about being able to relate to Yaakov as Yaakov Avinu. So you want to tell me, so Yaakov is a little foot soldier. So instead of not liking being a descendant of Yaakov as Yaakov Avinu, now you're a descendant of Rivka. So what difference did it make that I shifted everything over to Rivka? But by Rivka, the reason why this school of thought works a little bit is why? Because Rivka received an oracle when she was pregnant. And in that oracle it says that she's going to have twins. She's going to have two boys. And and the elder will work for the younger. Okay, so she, Rivka, remembers this. And she feels that in order to have that prophecy be fulfilled, she needs to encourage Yaakov to go get those blessings. So therefore she has some divine ordination and jurisdiction to go in and interfere with what's about to go on in order to fulfill the word of God. So when we shifted the blame away from Yaakov to Rivka, Rivka doesn't end up in a bad space. Rivka ends up in a good space because she has divine support. However, we need a little bit to understand this Virav Ya'avod Sa'ir. Now, I explained it as maybe it's commonly translated. Virav Ya'avod Sa'ir, the elder, Esav, Ya'avod Sa'ir, will work for the younger, Yaakov. However, it's not the correct wording, right? If we wanted to say that, it would be Virav, the elder, Ya'avid Sa'ir, will enslave the younger, right? He's going to make the other one work for him. Right? Virav Ya'avid Sa'ir. Virav Ya'avod Sa'ir, there it could mean Virav, it doesn't necessarily have to be the elder. Okay, we have a number of words in Tanakh, places in Tanakh where the word Rav is used. When the word Rav is used, it has multiple meanings. In one place, as we have Virav Mihiyot Kolot Elohim Umatar, that's enough. It's enough. Virav Ya'avod Sa'ir, and enough people will Ya'avod Sa'ir, will work for the younger. Doesn't necessarily have to include Esav. And similarly, throughout the passage, if you look at this perek, again and again and again, like Yaakov himself says, Anochi Esav Bechorecha. If we wanted to refer to Esav, it should have said, V'habechor Ya'avod Sa'ir. Why is it V'rav? Suddenly this word Rav doesn't appear later as a running theme. Rav also can mean an officer, someone of great standing. And so therefore V'rav Ya'avod Sa'ir can mean that an officer, someone great, will work for the younger. And if that's the case, so again, it doesn't have to include Esav. So we have a number of possibilities for this language of Virav Ya'avod Sa'ir. And Rivka takes one particular meaning that she feels is correct. Now let's think about this a minute. Rivka has to think all the following train of thoughts in order to justify her taking part in this chicanery. Number one, she has to believe that she has interpreted this oracle correctly. Number two, she feels the responsibility that she has to make this come true. Now, that's not at all clear. In other words, if God said this is going to happen, it doesn't matter what I do. God said that's what's going to happen. So why do I have to get involved? I shouldn't have to take any part in this. Even if Esav gets the blessings, it'll work out. Rav Ya'avod Sa'ir, God said. But no, Rivka is saying, no, I have to actively partake of this. And not only do I have to actively partake, but I'm able to say the sentence that we all hate to hear, which is, the end justifies the means. And so therefore, if I feel I'm doing something good, I can do whatever I want to go get it. I think all of these are difficult to accept. But not only that, she has to think, she doesn't know what the blessings are that Yitzchak is going to give over now in that tent. She thinks she knows that whatever the bracha is that Yitzchak is going to say is going to be in contradiction to Rabbi Avot Sa'ir. Who said? In fact, if we look later on at the blessings, right? Hine mishmanei ha'aretz yem moshavecha. Right? You're going to talk about right? The beginning part of the blessings didn't talk about brothers at all. It just said you're going to have lots of prosperity. Who knew? Maybe that was the entirety of the blessing. Maybe that was all it was going to be. How could she know that the blessing he's about to give is going to contradict this prophecy? And that Yitzchak is so powerful that his blessing is going to override God's nevuah. All of that has to be running through her head in order for her to take action the way this school of thought represents. And for that, that's why I have a problem with that school of thought, because it doesn't make sense to me that she went through this entire chain of thinking before acting in this situation. Now, also on a homiletics, on an ethical point of view, if we adopt this school of thought, it leads to very dangerous places. People in the world think that they've heard the word of God, or they've read the word of God, and that they've properly interpreted the word of God. And therefore, in order to achieve the word of God, they need to be the ones who bring God's word into fruition. And if that's the case, so I have to bring about the end of the days the way I see it. And the ends justify the means, and therefore I can do whatever I want to get that to happen. And unfortunately, there are many crazy people in the world who might feel that that's right up their alley. So it's not something I want to promote as the lesson to be learned from this episode. Well, obviously, if I'm not happy with these two schools of thought, so I need to introduce you another school of thought, and that's exactly what we're going to do right now. So we're going to open up on this sheet, and we're going to start with Pasuk Hey, number 5. And again, this is where we started looking at this earlier. So again, before Pasuk Hey, the first few Pasukim, Yitzchak is old, he's blind, he calls his eldest son Esav, he tells him, I don't know when I'm going to die, go get your hunting materials and go get me a hunt. And you'll make for me delicacies like I love, and you'll bring them, and I'll give you a blessing. And now we're on Pasuk 5. V'rivka shomayat adver Yitzchak le'Esav b'no, v'yelech Esav asedeh l'atzud tzayid d'avi. Rivka overheard what went on, and Esav went to the field to go get that hunt. V'rivka amra Yaakov b'na l'mor, hineh shamati et avicha medver l'Esav achicha l'mor. I overheard your father talking to your brother, saying, havi ali tzayid, bring for me a hunt. Bring me delicacies, I'll eat them. And I will bless you before God, before I die. Now let's pay attention. This is the plan. This is the plan I want you to do, my son. I'm going to command you now. Go to the flocks. Bring for me two good-looking goats. And I'll make the delicacies like your father loves. And then you'll bring them to your father and eat, so he'll bless you before he dies. And Yaakov tells Rivka, listen, mom, I don't know if you noticed this, mom, for the past 60 years, but my brother, he's more hairy than I am. And I'm a smooth man. Whether that means he's less hairy or just different grooming, different circumcision. Ulay musheni avi, maybe dad, my father, will feel me. Gahiti beinav kim tateya, and I'm going to be in his eyes like a mocker. I'll be making fun of him, that as if I thought I could fool him, that I was really Esav. You know, Yaakov is already in disbelief that this was ever going to work. You know, he's going to think I'm making fun of him. Veheveti alai kelala velo beracha, and I'm going to bring upon myself a curse. And not a blessing. Vatome Elohimu, alai kilatcha b'ni. Say, don't worry about it, son. This cursing thing that you're worried about, nothing to worry about. Shema bekoli velech kachli. Listen to what I have to tell you, and go get me the stuff. Now, let's look at this discussion. It looks to me that there's a total disconnect in this discussion. Okay, Rivka presents the plan that she has in mind. And she explains the entirety of the procedure here, step after step. Go to the flocks, get me the sheep, bring me the goat. I'll do the goat. I'll make the food. Step by step instructions. But we're missing something. Right? What's missing here in this whole description here? Go back and look it over. Yeah, I'll give you a few seconds. Take a look. What did she tell him to do? Look at verses number 9 and number 10. And what's the main thing that's missing here? That Yaakov basically is prompting afterwards. What is missing? Well, 9 and 10, here we are. They're looking, go get the goats, bring them back, we'll make the food, you'll go in, you'll get the blessing, you bet. Where's the masquerade? What happened to the whole plan? Yeah, Rivka has to have she called him over, she must have had the plan ready. Right? She's telling him to go in. Right? There's got to be something, he's got to get dressed up with something. And we see later on he gets dressed up, and Rivka is the one who dresses him up. So she knew that that was part of the plan. So why doesn't she tell him? And then, when she's prompted, right? Yaakov is basically saying, but Mom, it's not going to work, because I don't feel like Esav. So what should the answer be? Oh, I got that part figured out already, honey. I'm sorry I didn't tell you before, but you're going to get dressed up. I got the clothes in the closet. We're going to take the skins of the goat. We're going to put them on your arms and on your neck. It's going to work out fine. Don't worry about a thing. But instead of that, she doesn't answer that part at all. It's totally missing. She answers him, oh, you're worried about getting cursed? That was the second piece that he was worried about. What happened to the first issue he had? He has an issue about being identified as Yaakov by mistake instead of Esav. And instead of telling him, oh, I have that whole thing worked out, she leaves the whole thing out of her discussion. They're talking like this. They're not talking to each other. They're missing each other totally. She only addresses his second point. He said, oh, I may get cursed. She said, oh, don't worry about getting cursed. I'll help you there. I'll take care of it. I'll take the curse on me, whatever that means. So, the second thing we have here that's a problem for me, aside from this disconnect in the discussion, is that we're going to take a look now and see how Rivka relays the orders for the menu, and what exactly happens at the end. So let's take a look at Psukim, Gimel, and Dalet, 3 and 4. So the first time this is mentioned about what it is that Yitzchak is asking to have on the menu, he asks Esav to go and bring him a hunt, some venison, as they say in English, venison is the hunted animal, va'aseli mat'amim, so meat and delicacies. Now we're going to play a little bit of a game, maybe you remember from grade school. Which of the following does not belong? Okay? So the first thing is, we're going to have meat and delicacies. So that's the order, that's what Yitzchak wants. Now I'm not going to go into all of the details right now, but I'll go in a minute. But meat and delicacies. Now let's look at Pasuk number 7. Havi alitzai, this is what she reports to Yaakov, is the menu. Havi alitzai, bring me the meat. Vaseli matamim, and make me delicacies, ve'ochela. Okay, so again we have meat and delicacies. So far, so good, right? Everyone's with me, good. Pasuk number 9. Lechna el hatzon, this is now Rivka, asking Yaakov to go bring the items. Lechna el hatzon, ve'kachli misham shene gedeya izim tovim, go get the meat aspect, the goats. Ve'ese otam matamim, and I'll make for them, I'll make you a delicacy out of them. No one's jumping. So far, so good. That looks the same. Okay, Pasuk Yud Dalet, number 14. Vayelech vayikach. So he went and he got. What did he get? He got the goats. He got the meat aspect. Vayaveh le'imo. He brings it to his mom. Vatas imo matamim. And she made delicacies. Meat delicacies. No one's jumping. Very good. Okay, and now number 17. Okay, she's about to send him into the tent. This is the moment of truth. Here we go. Vatiten et hamatamim. And she gives the matamim. Ve'et halechem asher asata, and the bread that she made. Ve'yad Yaakov bina. Something's a little bit off, no? Right? We had meat and delicacies, meat and four times in like 10 psukim. Four times the Torah tells us the meat delicacies thing. There's a constant parallel: meat delicacies. Four times. Suddenly, the moment of truth comes, and the Torah says, "Oh yeah, and there was bread there too." You know, bread. Now, I have a lot of problems with this bread. Okay, now, I'm not against eating bread. Even the people who were in the last year, even though I have maybe something against the bread, the Egyptian bread, but the in regular eating, bread is fine. So what are the problems I have with this bread? First of all, it's not what he ordered. Right? Yitzchak had a specific order, and you're going to come back from the kitchen with the wrong order, he's going to send it back. So he's like, this is not what I need to get into the spirit of giving the blessing, right? We go to the steakhouse, don't give me filling up on bread, I want meat, only meat. Give me the steak, that's what I want. So that's number one. It doesn't fit the menu. Number two, look at the way the Torah explains what kind of bread she brings. Ve'et ha'lechem asher asata. The bread that she made. She made bread. Right? This is not, you can't go to the supermarket. If you want to have bread, so you have to go and make it. Now, aren't we a little bit in a rush here? Like, Esav's went to go get the hunt. He's going to come back. Who knows when he's coming back? And we got to get in and we got to make sure that there's no overlap there, because that would be terrible, right? There's an overlap, no good. We have to make sure Yaakov gets in, does the entire masquerading thing, gets the blessings, comes out before Esav comes back. And in the meantime, Rivka says, you know what? Before you go in, let me spend a couple of hours baking some bread. So if we're going to bake some bread and it's going to take that much time, it doesn't seem to fit the plan. There's something's wrong here with the plan. And we know in other places in Tanakh that when people are in a rush, they don't make bread. What do they make? They make matzot. Right, very good. They make matzot. Or there's even one more place that we see, like in Avraham, when the guests come, so he tells his wife, Lushi, need, meaning that that's the earliest stage, that the latest thing you can have is like flour waiting around. So you have to start kneading. Lushi va'asi ugot. Now what's ugot? Ugot are not cookies, right? Ugot apitot. Okay, go hurry up and make some pita. Okay, that's quick. So you either make pitot or you make matzah, but you don't make lechem. Okay, here she went ahead and made lechem. Now, in addition to this idea that there's a time factor that's going wrong, we also have another midrash that's beautiful midrash, that when Yitzchak brought Rivka home for the first time, so it says, "Vayvi'a Yitzchak ha'ohela Sara imo," to his mother Sarah's tent. And Chazal explained to us there that there were three things that Yitzchak longed for since his mother passed away. And since Rivka came in, she filled in those gaps that he was missing. One was that there was a cloud that was always over the tent, meaning that there was a presence of God, there was some sense of holiness going on in the home. That the candles. And the last one was the bread, the challah. Okay, Shai Bracha Shora Ba'isa. That there was a blessing in the dough. Now, what's this blessing in the dough? First of all, it meant that she made amazing challah. That was the first thing, for sure. He finally got that homemade taste of the bread. But number two, as we mentioned in the other class, is it's possible that the rest of the world didn't know yet about yeast. They didn't know about yeast yet. It's only going to be invented in Egypt a couple hundred years later. So it could be that Rivka and Sarah, they knew this secret. And that's the bracha, that's the extra blessing that they have in their bread that no one else can have. It's the secret family recipe. So that the se'or, this yeast, could have been that. And if there is yeast, so then we have to add another couple of hours for the dough to rise. And that's why I'm bringing all of this in, because that's going to add another problem in the timing. So we have here those three points. Number one, it's not what Yitzchak ordered. Number two, that it's going to take a lot of time. And number three is that we mentioned just now that she makes amazing challah. And this is fresh baked challah. Now, when Yaakov walks in to that tent, you have to like take it all in. So the first thing is the smell of fresh baked challah. Now, the minute he smells that challah, that's like Rivka's signet. Like that's Rivka. Like the second he smells it, that's my wife's challah. That's my wife. Now, is that a smart thing to send in with Yaakov if you want him to go and in as Esav? The pasuk earlier, that's not on the sheet, says, "Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav kitzayid befiv, v'Rivka ohevet et Yaakov." There was this affinity going on between Yitzchak and Esav, and there's an affinity between Rivka and Yaakov. Now, Esav, he's not really going to have so much access to his mother's bread, because he's always in the field, number one. And number two, it's not exactly, they're not getting along too well all the time. She's in love with Yaakov more than Esav. So if that's the case, when he smells that bread, he's going to associate it with the duo of Rachel and Yaakov. Rivka and Yaakov. Thank you. So that's going to give away this masquerade. So that's again against the interest of the plan. So what is it that we're going to have as the solution to this introduction of bread that looks like it's going to destroy the entire plan? So let's go back to that pasuk I just mentioned earlier. Vayahav Yitzchak et Esav ki tzayid b'fiv. Yitzchak loved Esav because of the hunt in his mouth. Verivka ohevet et Yaakov. Now we have other psukim in the Torah that explain to us about people favoring one over the other. So one of them is in regards to Yaakov loving Rachel more than Leah. And there it says, Vayavo gam el Rachel, Vayahav gam et Rachel mi Leah. Yaakov loved Rachel from Leah, over Leah, this mem, me Leah. And we also have a similar verse when it comes to Yosef and the brothers. Vayu echav, ki oto ahav avihem, mi kol banav. He loved Yosef more than everybody else. But in our verse, we don't have a mem. There's no, he loved Esav more than Yaakov. He loved Esav because Esav brought him the food. So what does that mean for us? It means that while in the other situations, there was something inherent to the people that made them lovable and not lovable, here, it was mechanical. Here, Yitzchak loving Esav was not because Esav was some special guy. It was because Esav brought the hunt. And therefore, it's not that Yitzchak doesn't love Yaakov, it's that Yaakov hadn't provided any venison for him. Now let's take a moment, I think we have enough time, I'll get it in, that why is it that Yitzchak is so taken up with the meat? We would like to think of him as someone a little bit higher stature than just being motivated all the time by eating a good barbecue. So, I think if we take a look back in Yitzchak's life, that momentous traumatic occasion of Akedat Yitzchak, Yitzchak is tied up to the altar. And Avraham takes the knife and he's about to kill his son. And then what does the pasuk say? The verse reads, Vayikra elav malach Adonai min hashamayim, Vayomer Avraham, Avraham, Vayomer hineni. The angel calls out to him from the heavens and says, Avraham, Avraham, and Avraham answers, here I am. And then the angel goes on to explain, Al tishlach yadcha lana, don't kill him. Now wait a second. What did we say? Let's go back in the Hebrew. Vayikra elav malach Hashem in hashamayim. The angel called out to him, meaning to Avraham. Meaning that this entire discussion with the content of this life-saving information, Yitzchak's not hearing any of it. Only Avraham is hearing it. And Avraham just says one word, hineni. Yitzchak is sitting on, is lying down, tied up to the altar, and the only word he hears is his father say, here I am. He doesn't know who he's talking to or what is going on. All he knows is that his father froze. He's pretty happy about that, but it doesn't look like the danger has passed yet. After the angel finishes talking, Avraham runs and gets the ram that was stuck. He brings the ram over, okay? And he doesn't untie Yitzchak yet, right? Because he has to run to get the ram, because the ram's about to get loose and run away. So he has to get the ram. He gets the ram first. So he gets the ram first. He comes. He takes Yitzchak off. He takes the ram. He puts it on instead of Yitzchak. Yitzchak is still at the foot of the altar, tied up. And he offers the sacrifice of the ram. The ram is being burnt at the altar. Yitzchak is now free. And Avraham lets him go. So for Yitzchak, this smell, this aroma of the barbecue meat, of the meat on the altar, is not just, I like meat, I'm hungry. It's this euphoria of living, reenacting his being saved at Akedah. This was the moment that he understood that his life was being given back to him. So forevermore, Yitzchak has this association, and anybody who can bring him that elation again by giving him the meat is someone who Yitzchak is going to bring close to him. Until now in the story, it was always Esav. So now that we understand a little bit that this meat is a little bit of a deeper feeling perhaps for Yitzchak than just a gustatorial experience. So now let's go back to what's going on here. When Yaakov hears Rivka tell him, go in and get the blessings, Yaakov says, you know, we live in this house a long time. And everybody understands how things work here. Okay? We need a verse to tell us, "Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav Kitzayit b'fiv." Right? We need to read that because we don't live at the house. But they live it every day. They don't need a verse to tell them this is how it works. They all understood that Esav was Yitzchak's favorite, Yaakov was Rivka's favorite. So Yaakov says, you know, mom knows all that. So it can't be that I'm going to go in there just stam like this because I wasn't invited to the party. It wasn't something that Yitzchak wants me to come in and do. So therefore he says it must be that I'm going to go in as Esav. But the truth of the matter is that when Rivka speaks to Yaakov, and we should look inside again just to see the language that Rivka says. Pasuk number 8. Listen to what I'm going to tell you. Number 9. Go to the flocks and get the goats, and I'm going to make them into delicacies like your father loves, and you'll bring them to your father and he'll eat, so he will bless you before he dies. So I would like to say is that Rivka originally is suggesting that Yaakov go in as Yaakov. She's not interested in having him masquerade as Esav at all. She feels that Yitzchak will be loving enough to give also Yaakov his own independent blessing. And that's why she doesn't mention the masquerade at all. Because she doesn't think there's going to be a masquerade. Yaakov, on the other hand, feels that it's impossible that my father will give me the blessing. I wasn't invited to this party. And therefore, he doesn't love me the way he loves Esav. I know the way he looks at him and the way he treats him and the way that he smiles when he comes in the room. That's not me. I'm never going to get a blessing on my own. So he starts saying, I must be going in as Esav. And Rivka, her mindset is still, you're going in as Yaakov. So when she starts hearing Yaakov going on about, maybe my father's going to feel me and he's going to think I'm a mocker, Rivka is like, what? What are you talking about? Like, she doesn't understand that whole sentence. That she doesn't understand at all. She doesn't understand that sentence whatsoever. All she heard at the end that she understood was, whatever it is that Yaakov was worried about, that whole feeling thing, I don't know what that's about, but whatever he was worried about, the bottom line is he thought that Yitzchak is going to curse him. Yitzchak's not going to curse you, son. Don't worry. He loves you. You'll get a blessing. Don't worry. If there's a curse, I'll take the curse. You're worried about a curse. So that's the only thing she can relate to. That's the only thing that made sense to her. Because she's still in her mind sending Yaakov in as Yaakov. So she sends Yaakov to the flocks. So Yaakov is busy getting the animals. Now let's take a look at the verses. When is it that Rivka begins cooperation in a masquerading? It's not early on. There's definitely, like we said, there's no mention of it. It's only after Pasuk 14, verse number 14. Vayelech, vayikach, vayavel imo, vatas imo matamim. She finishes making the delicacies. Okay, it's ready to go. Kasher hevaviv. It takes a long time to do all of that. Only after all of that, somewhere along the line in the process of preparing that food, she understands what it is that Yaakov thought. And she says, oh my gosh, that's what he thinks? That's what he thinks is the way the family works? That Yitzchak is so in love with Esav as opposed to him, he's not going to get a blessing, only a curse? So Rivka is still thinking that she got into a big mess right now. Because she thought that Yaakov is going to go in as Yaakov, and Yaakov doesn't feel he can get a bracha. And then she stops and she thinks, you know, maybe he's right. Maybe he has a relationship with his father more than I do. He knows what kind of a reaction his father would have with him more than I should know. And if he's right, so this is bad news. This is not good. Something has to happen here. How am I going to make this work? Well, that's when Rivka says, you know, maybe the best thing is really to stall. Instead of having Yaakov rush in and get all of this bracha going on, let's take some time and make a costume for Yaakov. And let's take the skins and let's work them so that he can wear them. You know, cut them exactly so it fits the sleeves. I'll put it on his neck. I'll go get the clothes from the house of Esav. I have to go to the house, find in the closet. I don't know, maybe his graduation suit. I don't know what he has there. So she puts all of that on him and ready to go. And Esav's not home. So what am I going to do? Now Rivka, maybe, okay, and this is a little bit pushing, but perhaps, Rivka also says to herself, you know, how could Yitzchak not love Yaakov? You know, Yaakov is so much like me. He's a tent dweller, Yoshev tam ish tam Yoshev ohalim, and I'm a tent dweller. We're both people. We hang out in tents. We're the homebodies. If he doesn't like Yaakov, then what does that say about me? Oh, I'm not going there. This is not up my alley. I'm not ready to partake in this anymore. This has to not happen. Well, I got the clothes thing. I did that, and I get the food is ready. So what am I going to do now? Time to bake bread. Time to bake some bread. So I'm going to make some bread, and it's going to take a good couple of hours, and God willing, Esav is coming home. And she finishes the entirety of the bread, and Esav is not home yet. So what's she going to do? Well, she sends in the bread, because she's hoping that somehow Yitzchak is going to figure something out and understand this middle ground of a confused element, that really there's someone here who looks like Esav, maybe you should like him. And at the same time, you know it's not really him. Here's the bread element, that's me, Rivka, and Rivka goes with Yaakov. She says, we're going to send in this confused picture. For sure, I'm not going to send in Yaakov as Yaakov alone, because that could lead to a crushing depression. And I also don't want to send him in to be discovered right away, because that could be a revelation of how Yitzchak really feels about me, and I'm not ready to go there. Well, if we're looking at it in that light, when he walks in, we said that really we should have this smell of the aroma of the bread to be able to identify right away that that was Rivka. But that's not what happens. So where did this bread go? Okay. Well, let's take a look at the revelation of who was who in the Pesukim. So if you look in Pasuk Lamed Gimel, 33, on the second side of the sheet. Yitzchak asks Esav, who are you? And Esav says, oh, I'm your firstborn Esav. The real Esav came in. Vayecherad Yitzchak charada gedola ad meod. And he got very fearful and with trepidation. Vayomer mi efohu hatzad said vayaveli vaochal mikol betelem tavo vavarechehu. Who was that masked man? Who was that person who came in before and I ate all the food that they ate? They gave me. They blessed him. Gam Baruch Yeh, he should be blessed also. Kishmo Esav et Debrei Aviv, and he calls out. Esav starts crying and screaming. Give me a bracha also, Abba. Then Pasuk 35. Vayomer, Yitzchak answers him. Ba achicha b'mirma v'yikach b'rchatecha. Your brother came in trickery and took your blessing. What do you mean your brother came? Two psukim ago, 1 second ago in the talking, he didn't understand who it was. And you would have thought he would figure it out because he himself said before, Hakol kol Yaakov, v'hayadayim v'dei Esav. He understood that there was this mixed picture that Rivka sent him of the hands being the hands of Esav and the voice of that of Yaakov. So there was only two choices, right? So if it wasn't really Esav, so who should have been the choice? Yaakov. But Yitzchak doesn't make that jump immediately because in the beginning he tells Esav, who was that masked man? Who came in before? Suddenly now, he says, Ba achicha b'mirma. He knows that it's your brother. So I'd like to suggest that if we look at the language that we have in regards to Pasuk 33, it says, Hu hatzad, who was the person who brought me the venison? Vayaveli va'ochal mikol betenem tavo va'arechehu. Who was the person that I ate from all of what they brought me? And then Yitzchak is making a scan of all the food that he ate, and there's the bread. When he starts thinking about all the food that he ate and he realizes the bread came in, that's when he knows now that it was Yaakov. So what do we gain out of this entire approach that we've suggested here in order to enlighten us as to what the role is that Yaakov took in the switch? I'm not saying that Yaakov's actions were ethical and moral and without what to critique. I'm saying, though, that instead of viewing Yaakov as some dastardly villain who is just out to get what he wants, who's ready to hurt his father and his brother and do what it takes to get what he wants. Yaakov is thinking that perhaps just this one time, when I go before my father, I can be the beloved son. For once, I want to know what that's like. Because my father's about to die, and I'm never going to get it if I don't do it now. If I don't go in now as Esav, I'm never going to feel that love from my father. So I think that it's Yaakov's emotional stress and distress, and the feeling that he has that he wants to be the one that's loved by his father, that sends him in dressed up as Esav. And the entire constellation of Yaakov, Rivka, and Yitzchak is a much deeper picture of relationships and people not feeling certain about where they stand within the family and the family dynamics. But I think also, if we're looking for lessons that we can relate to better, and we don't want to make the ends justify the means, I think that a lesson that's going to be learned from is that we all have, well, many people have children that they have to deal with growing up, and the difficulty of giving everyone the attention that they need, the message that perhaps is being told to us is, make sure that your children don't think they need to be somebody else in order to get your love and attention. And that they don't have to be like the neighbor's kid, and they don't have to be like their brother or their sister, that everyone has their special place in the family, and let them feel it from you, so that they don't have these misimpressions that Yaakov had of Yitzchak, his father. And I think that this type of family dynamic and this type of analysis of the stories of Yaakov give us the ability to have deeper insights to a real family with real emotions that were dealing with issues amongst themselves in a way that we can relate to much more on a day-to-day basis. Thank you. Well, I don't think so, because here, according to what I've just suggested, Rivka never suggested the switch to begin with. It was only Yaakov's mind that he thought that that's what she was saying. Yaakov thought that when she sends him in, that he reasons to himself, of course she can't ask me to go in as Yaakov, as myself, I must get dressed up as Esav. But really, Rivka was just saying, you're his son, you'll go in as yourself and you'll get a blessing. It was only in Yaakov's mind that she was suggesting a switch. But in reality, Yaakov was the one who hatched the plan of making the masquerade.
But what about the food that she suggested?
Right, so she suggests, she says, listen, your father is expecting a meal in order to get into the atmosphere of giving a blessing. And now, you're not in the position to make food, you don't cook. I'm the one who cooks around here, so I'll give you the food so that you can go in and get that blessing. She's going to help him, but she wants him to go in as Yaakov. And that's where the misunderstanding occurs. Yes? Right, so I see that basically the textual support that I have is the disconnect in the discussion between Rivka and Yaakov, that the questions that Yaakov asks are not being answered. Rivka is not addressing that at all. Rivka's initial plan, which is detailed about go to the flocks and get me the goats and bring them back and I'll make the food, is totally lacking of the masquerade idea. And the idea that despite the text giving us four times in 10 psukim the same duo of meat and delicacies, Rivka decides to veer from the menu. And I think that all of that put together, especially the language here, you also have the language of Rivka telling him, so in order, in Pasuk 10, he should bless you before he dies. Not you as Esav, you as Yaakov. Yes.
Between them, they know that means that he loves me.
Okay, I think that you could maintain that, but the problem you're going to have with that approach is that Ulay Musheni Avi. In other words, why is it that Yaakov would say Ulay Musheni Avi if it was understood between them? So I think that my approach, when I'm saying that they knew what's going on a verse like Ve'ehav Yitzchak et Esav Kitzayit Befiv, that they knew who liked each other, who was each other's favorite, I think that that's a legitimate assumption. The assumption of what the plan is in this particular situation in terms of getting the goat skins to cover his arms and for him to be pulling off a masquerade, especially when he's basically prompting that response and not getting it, I think that that's a legitimate also there to be able to say that the text is actually telling us that that was not the plan initially. Yeah. Wow.
So it really does, I could see it as being very realistic. My question is, where is it defined what meat and delicacies are? Because in my mind, well, goat is a kind of meat. I know it has a very different taste and smell than medicine, but they're still quite pungent. And bread to me could be a delicacy, especially if it's made in such a particular manner.
Right. So I think, though, that you could have interpreted it that way, but I think that the fact that the text went out of its way to use the words dagdi and matamim, and then switches it only at the end with bread, with the word lechem, I think that that's what's coming to draw attention. If it was a parallel exactly, one of those other four times you would have had the bread mentioned, or the last time would have been matamim. The fact that there's four continuous the same, and the fifth one, which is the aberration, I think is what really draws the attention to the disparity. Yes. Yeah. So okay. Well, again, I don't think that he is that much aware. He definitely is using all of his senses. He's not senile, even though he's old. He definitely has all of his senses. He uses his sense of touch, of smell. He kisses him. He asks him three times who he is. He's definitely in control of the situation. He's using the best of his abilities to identify who's before him. And based on that, he gives over the blessings. I don't think we have much more to critique him. It's only after the fact that there's a switch that we understand, oh, he could have, should have been more cognizant. But going into the situation, who would have imagined that someone's going to come in masqueraded as somebody else? It's almost like a comedy sitcom. I'm sorry, the rabbi cut me.
Sorry.
I'll take him privately.
Just, you know, keep on time. He is going back to Israel, but only in about 3 hours. So, okay, thank you very much. The last session, Rabbi Horowitz in here on separation of church and state. And Rabbi Natap in the other room on human creativity and halakha. Okay, I will take a 3-minute break, and wish Rabbi Dishi a good trip back to Israel.